Israel begins another major offensive in southern Gaza aimed at taking out the newly named leader of Hamas.
President Biden's going to continue to do what's right. He has Israel's back against Iran and its proxy groups.
The Kremlin declares a federal emergency in its Kursk region after Ukrainian troops poured across the border onto Russian soil.
Ukrainian officials have been silent on the operation, which appears to be one of the biggest cross-border forays by Ukraine into Russia.
And new polls show Kamala Harris edging ahead of Donald Trump. Could Americans elect the first female president?
I think it's the final obstacle that women in politics have not yet achieved.
Today is Saturday, August 10th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Continuing to target Hamas fighters, Israeli troops launched a new assault Friday into the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. It's at least the third time that Israeli forces have launched a major incursion in the area, where Israeli and American officials believe Yahya Sinwar, Hamas's newly named top leader and one of the architects of the October 7th attack on Israel, could be hiding. Sinwar took the role after top Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh was killed in the Iranian capital by a hidden bomb widely attributed to Israel. We hear more from Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Since the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israeli civilians, Israel has worked to assassinate all of Hamas's leaders. One who has managed to avoid getting killed is Yahya Sinwar, the man who is now leading the group. He is believed to be hiding underground in a tunnel in Gaza, using Israeli hostages as human shields. Gershon Baskin spent years indirectly negotiating with Sinwar for the release of a kidnapped Israeli soldier.
Today, Yahya Sinwar runs the political bureau and the military wing of Hamas. This is the first time that all the power within Hamas is in the hands of one person, and it happens to be the one person who is maybe the most extreme person within Hamas.
Baskin doesn't expect any major changes in Hamas's negotiating position for a ceasefire that could end the war in Gaza and free the remaining hostages. He says Sinwar is known as an extremist.
He is, without question, very extreme, very religious, has a distorted view of what Islam is, believes that the most important commandment in his version of Islam is to be a martyr for Palestine.
Israel sentenced Sinwar to life imprisonment in 1989 for masterminding an attack that killed two Israeli soldiers and for killing four Palestinian collaborators. He spent more than 20 years in Israeli jails, speaks Hebrew fluently, and sees himself as an expert on Israel. He was one of more than 1,000 Hamas prisoners released in 2011 in exchange for kidnapped Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Israeli officials say they are determined to kill Sinwar, as they have other Hamas leaders involved in the October 7th attacks that triggered this war. Israeli Army Chief Herzl Halevi says Sinwar's rise as leader of Hamas gives Israel an even greater motive to find him. He says Israel will work to kill Hamas's leaders as quickly as the group replaces them. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Iran has vowed to retaliate after the killings of the Hamas leader and a top commander of the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah in a strike on a Beirut suburb. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby, speaking with reporters Friday, said the U.S. takes Iran's threats seriously.
He has directed that we do everything possible to defend Israel, and that's what we're doing. We met again yesterday in the Oval Office with Secretary Austin and his team to address ongoing military preparations.
With growing concerns of a retaliatory Iranian attack that could trigger a wider regional war, leaders from the United States, Egypt, and Qatar have renewed their push for Israel and Hamas to reach a ceasefire deal. Israel said it would attend the new round of talks scheduled for August 15th.
President Biden's going to continue to do what's right. He has Israel's back against Iran and its proxy groups. He has Israel's back on this deal.
But just how much leverage does the U.S. have over Israel's actions? Joining us for insights into that question is Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow for U.S. Policy at the Middle East Institute.
The U.S. has a greater capacity than any other country from outside the region to shape the events. As we saw in April, in mid-April, when Iran fired more than 350 ballistic missiles and drones at Israel, and then Israel retaliated. That was a rather constrained response. It didn't have much damage inside of Israel or Iran, and that was because the U.S. played a role. No other country, not China, not Russia, none of the European countries can play that role. So it's important to highlight that recent experience, but it's also important to remind ourselves that the United States is not the driver of these events. It's Israel, it's Iran, it's two terrorist groups, Hamas and Hezbollah. And because of that, and because those two terror groups are non-state actors effectively, there's a great degree of unpredictability here and uncertainty, especially after the assassination of these two leaders, the one Hezbollah leader in Beirut and Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader in Tehran, which was quite provocative. So I know the last couple of days, the United States has been working by, with, and through Arab partners, especially Jordan, Egypt, some of the Gulf states, to send signals to Iran to basically have a much more measured response, if no response at all. But I'm not sure it'll work this time because of how provocative an assassination in the capital city, Tehran, of Iran was for the Iranian regime.
If there were to be a full-blown war, would the U.S. be somewhat obligated to defend Israel and, in effect, get itself into a war?
It really depends on what the next spark might be. There's no treaty obligation in the sense that we have with NATO allies in Europe. But the reality is that the United States, just in the last few days, faced attacks from Iranian-backed militias in Iraq. And we've seen that before. We've seen that also the Houthi attacks in Yemen against international shipping in the Red Sea. So what's often forgotten in the debate here, and with some who just simply point a finger at Israel and then simply say, well, if the U.S. just reads Israel the Riot Act and cuts off military cooperation and arms sales, this will somehow magically solve the situation. That's fantasy land, because it ignores the reality that Iran for decades has been investing in a network of terror groups that have actually undermined the stability of not just the countries of Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, but broader regional and now increasingly global security. And the U.S. is not obligated to respond, but if the U.S. sees its own troops under fire from the same network of groups that are out there, it's sort of hard to disassociate ourselves from any actions that Israel takes. But again, in this instance, as President Biden has said, in the instance of especially the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader in Tehran, it was not helpful to what I think is still the primary objective of the Biden team, which is to get a ceasefire in Israel and Hamas.
And they've been saying, the Biden administration has been saying, ceasefire and hostage release talks are in the final stages. We've been hearing that for a while. It would seem counterintuitive for Israel to kill the Hamas leader who was actually representing the group in ceasefire hostage release negotiations. What's their incentive at this point? And do you really think that's accurate to say that we could be close to a deal anyway?
They have been saying, the Biden team has been saying that for many months now. And in essence, let's remember, you know, there's been one ceasefire in late November or early December for about a week between Israel and Hamas that led to not just the cessation of hostilities in Gaza, but it actually calmed the situation in the region. And that's a good thing. And it also importantly led to many hostages coming home, but not all of them. Now Hamas was the one that broke the ceasefire, that first ceasefire, because there was an attempt to extend it. Then there's been ongoing negotiations essentially since that moment, essentially for the last 8-9 months. It's gone up and down. There's actually been previous murders, assassinations, and strikes against Hamas officials involved in negotiations. Most prominently in January, there was a Hamas official in Beirut who was killed, who was a key interlocutor between Hamas and Qatar. Now, I see sort of these actions by the Israeli government to target Hamas's leadership as just the fulfillment of what they promised they would do. They essentially said, look, the leaders of this movement that killed more than 1,200 of our people and held many hostage, they're going to be targets in all of this. That's their definition of self-defense. That's how they think they're going to keep themselves safe. But it is at odds with trying to get to a negotiated settlement that releases the hostages. Now, Haniyeh, the man who was killed last week in Tehran, I would say he was a bit more peripheral to the decision-making on the ceasefire talks, the key person is Yahya Sinwar, who's now been named the political and military leader of Hamas. He's the guy that's in the tunnels, and he was pivotal. If anything, Haniya was the political face and diplomatic face, important, but not pivotal to getting to yes on a decision. So long story short is I think the Biden team has pinned a lot of its policies on getting this elusive ceasefire in place. Problem with that is that the two central combatants to the war in Gaza, Israel and Hamas, are led by leaders that don't seem to look to diplomacy and a settlement to settle their interests. They still turn to force, and in the case of Hamas, holding on to hostages as their ultimate trump card to try to stay alive and survive as a movement.
Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow for U.S. Policy at the Middle East Institute. Thank you so much. Russian and Ukrainian forces clashed in Russia's Kursk region for a fourth consecutive day Friday, according to Russia's defense ministry. While Ukrainian officials are saying little, its incursion on Russian soil appears to have the blessing of the United States. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden has this update.
A house in Russia's Kursk region on fire. Video from the Russian media outlet Izvestia showing the apparent aftermath of the Ukrainian incursion. Ukrainian officials have been silent on the operation, which appears to be one of the biggest cross-border forays by Ukraine into Russia since Moscow launched its invasion of Ukraine more than 2 years ago. So far, though, the Ukrainian maneuver has the support of the U.S.
Yes, it is. It is consistent with our policy.
Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh telling reporters the U.S. still does not support any long-range Ukrainian attacks into Russia, but she says this is different.
They are taking actions to protect themselves from attacks that are coming from a region that are within the U.S. policy of where they can operate, our weapons, our systems, our capabilities.
Singh also says the U.S. sees the Ukrainian actions advancing by some estimates as far as 10 kilometers into Russia as defensive.
As they see attacks coming across the border, they have to be able to have the capabilities to respond. And so you're seeing some of these cross-border counterfire measures.
Russian defense officials say the Ukrainian incursion has been suppressed. Still, some Russian civilians are leaving. We began to evacuate. Kursk region acting governor Alexei Smirnov said Thursday, talking to Russian President Vladimir Putin on a video call, he accused Ukrainian forces of targeting civilian structures. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
The Ukrainian cross-border incursion follows unrelenting Kremlin attacks in recent months along its eastern front lines. On Friday, a Russian missile hit a Ukrainian shopping mall in the frontline Donetsk region, killing at least 14 people and injuring dozens more. I spoke with Ukrainian political commentator Mykolai Davidovich in Kyiv for his take on these developments.
That showed that the war may not be under control. What Putin promised in a shadow to some Western political leaders. And he tried to show that he is so strong and can control everything inside Ukraine. And now Ukraine showed that we have possibilities, even sometimes without using Western weapons. I think what's going on in Kursk region make nervous a little bit the West, but all our neighbors, such as Baltic states and Poland, they smiling and they so motivated on that. But I think one player who looking on that and studying, and that is China, because China also may be interesting if they see that Russia is too weak. They may be motivated to do the same on Siberia or in their territories, which was occupied by Russia 150 or 60 years ago. And so they are looking on this situation very seriously. For them, it's interesting their huge and strong neighbor could be so weak. And I think that's not only perspective of the West, but it's also perspective of China. When like 1,000 people come to the territory, half of the week, and also going through the region towards the atomic power station.
Does it raise the danger level for Ukraine, for some serious, even more serious retaliation?
What may happen more seriously than it happened after these 2.5 years? They striking all the time in Ukraine, in Western Ukraine, in Eastern Ukraine, 40 to 50 strikes in Kherson. They targeted the maternity house, the civilian buildings, Okhmadit, the hospital, the children's hospital. What may happen worse when Ukrainian army entered Russia and show that they are not so strong as they trying to show themselves, just the 1,000 of militaries. And that's also a good message to NATO. When the many European politicians or Western politicians say like, oh, we don't know how to fight against Russia, they're so strong, Putin sends so strong messages. But when we check this situation, that is a question of courage and leadership. This operation planned and stand on two huge values, that is a courage and leadership. So I'm not sure that Russia may act more aggressively.
Political commentator Mykolaiv Davyduk in Kyiv. Thanks so much. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. With less than 3 months to Election Day, U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and his Democratic opponent, Kamala Harris, have agreed to a debate. More from Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer.
Set for September 10th on ABC, it will be the first face-to-face matchup between the rivals in what polls show is an extremely close race. On Thursday afternoon, Trump appeared publicly for the first time since Harris picked Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate.
I think it's very important to have debates.
Trump said he wanted additional debates on September 4th and September 25th that would air on Fox and NBC. He had previously suggested he might back out of the ABC debate, which was scheduled before Harris replaced President Joe Biden as the Democratic candidate less than 3 weeks ago. After Trump's comments, Harris spoke to reporters before leaving Michigan.
I'm glad that he's finally agreed to a debate on September 10th. I'm looking forward to it and hope he shows up.
An Ipsos poll published on Thursday found Harris had widened her lead over Trump. She leads Trump 42% to 37%, compared to a 37% to 34% lead over Trump in late July.
That was Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reporting. And with Kamala Harris now the Democratic nominee, she has the potential to make history as the first female president of the United States. For perspective on the significance of what that would mean, we're joined by Jennifer Lawless, director of the politics department at the University of Virginia and the author of Women on the Run, Gender, Media, and Political Campaigns in a Polarized Era.
I think it's the final obstacle that women in politics have not yet achieved. They haven't broken through yet. We've had a woman as the Democratic Party's nominee. She won the popular vote, Hillary Clinton. And so those were two major achievements. We've had a female vice president. That's the other crowning achievement. But we haven't had a female president. And so for people who are wondering, when is that going to happen? For people who believe that that's an indicator of growth in terms of attitudes toward women or discrimination or sexism, electing Kamala Harris president of the United States would quell some of those concerns. Now, that's not to say that we can then pack up and say our work is done. There's no such thing as gender bias or discrimination, and we have total equality in our society. But symbolically, it's a really important milestone.
Is America, do you think at this point, ready? Is now the time, particularly given we're seeing many of the freedoms women have enjoyed for many years being rolled back as far as things like abortion?
Well, I think Democratic candidates in general have demonstrated a commitment to protecting a woman's right to choose and to prioritizing that issue in a very compelling way. So I don't think you only need a female candidate or a female elected leader to protect reproductive rights or to encourage people to fight for reproductive rights. That said, Kamala Harris has been one of the most outspoken, credible, and compelling elected officials we've had on that issue. So the confluence of her ability to speak well about that issue, her passion for it, and the fact that it's at the top of the agenda for women in this country because Roe versus Wade was overturned are a set of circumstances that, you know, I think are particularly helpful for her. But in general, we've seen in the 2022 midterms and in various special elections since Roe v. Wade was overturned that Democratic candidates, male and female alike, have been able to do an excellent job talking about the issue, rallying the troops, and ultimately actually winning.
Right. It seems almost like some of these freedoms that have been pushed back, and it on one hand looked like the U.S. has changed, or we thought it was moving in a more conservative direction with some of these Supreme Court rulings and these state laws. Do you think that in general has sort of elevated the level of motivation to fight for not only these issues, but part of what has excited the base that is now so on board with Kamala Harris?
Right. So the abortion issue is certainly something that has motivated Democratic voters and Democratic women in particular, although we've seen suburban women who are independents get very engaged around this issue as well. I think part of the excitement around Kamala Harris, or a large part of the excitement around Kamala Harris, is that she's not Joe Biden, and voters now believe that there's a chance that the Democrats could defeat Donald Trump. So there was a sense of resigned acceptance, and that resigned acceptance that Biden was not going to be able to run a vigorous campaign and ultimately win also meant accepting what the future would look like when there wouldn't be any sort of push for reproductive rights. There wouldn't be any push to restore the kinds of freedoms and protections that we've seen the Supreme Court take away from voters. So I think some of it is the excitement about what her agenda represents. But some of it, quite frankly, is just the idea that there's a contest again and Democrats could win.
It has seemed that it has been easier for Americans to envision a man being elected to this office as a president. Women broke the barrier, obviously. We have now a female vice president. We had an African-American president with Barack Obama. But it does seem like women in leadership roles still face many more obstacles than men. Do you think that's changing, or is that still the case?
So I think it's complicated. The first thing that I always point to is that there might be obstacles and there might be bias and discrimination, and some of that is episodic as opposed to systematic. But female candidates have learned how to navigate that terrain so that even when those episodes occur, they typically tend not to be determinative. And if we look back at 2016 and we see what Hillary Clinton endured during both the primary and the general election, you know, she did win the popular vote. So that's not how we elect candidates in this country, but she received more than 3,000 more votes than Donald Trump did, suggesting that the American people are ready and willing to elect a woman, or at least to cast a ballot for a woman. The other thing is, we've only had one opportunity to test this out at the presidential level. So I think depending on Kamala Harris's experiences on the campaign trail, depending on the outcome, we're going to know a lot more about 2016, actually, and whether Hillary Clinton's experiences had to do with the fact that she was a female candidate or had to do with the fact that she was Hillary Clinton. Beyond the presidency, when women run for office in primaries and general elections, they raise just as much money. They garner very similar media coverage. They win by comparable margins. So again, that's not to say there aren't episodes of bias or discrimination, but we have reached a point in this country where people are completely willing to donate to, cover, and elect women.
Why do you think it is that many other Western countries, it seemed very natural and organic to see women in these high roles or even as leaders of their country? Why has it taken so long for America to get to this point?
Well, so the first book I ever wrote was called It Takes a Candidate, and that's my answer. You can't elect people if they don't run. And it really was not until 2016 that we had a female candidate emerge who had at least as much political experience, the same kinds of qualifications, and the same political background as competitive male contenders. In 2004, Carol Moseley Braun ran. In 2000, I think, Elizabeth Dole ran. These were women who had been in the Senate for one term. They didn't have the kind of background that the people against whom they were running did. They didn't win, but neither did many, many other men who were competing in those contests. 2008, Hillary Clinton came close in the Democratic primary, but she was running against somebody who became a global superstar. Barack Obama was like a candidate we had never before seen. And so there just have not been that many women to run, you know, who have those backgrounds and qualifications. Now, one example that counters that statement is 2020, where you did have Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren competing for the Democratic nomination that Joe Biden ultimately won. Except Joe Biden, in a lot of ways, was the incumbent. He had been vice president. He chose to sit out 2016, but he was back for 2020. So again, even though you had a lot of women on the stage who didn't win, you also had a lot of men on the stage who didn't win, and they lost to the obvious nominee, given that Biden was vice president. So I think over time, we're going to see more and more women emerge, not only because because we've now had a female vice president, but because when we look to governors, when we look to senators, we're seeing an increasing number of women holding those positions, gaining those credentials, garnering national attention and name recognition, and putting themselves in the kinds of positions that a woman like Hillary Clinton was in 2016.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Lawless, director of the Politics Department at the University of Virginia and author of Women on the Run. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.